Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about August 18th, 2018, New Scientist episode. I believe it would probably be about 4. I'm just reading through, just for cardiac rehab, the articles by Alice Klein, Climate Justice Now, Women Fight Back Over the Environment, inspires Alice Klein. This is a book review, I think. It's a Mothers of Invention podcast, available online, produced by a non-profit Doc Society. California and Portugal are burning, Greece is in ashes, and heat stress fish are dying in droves in Germany. It's easy to despair at the full force of climate change is felt across the Northern Hemisphere. Amid this gloom, Mothers of Invention, a six-part podcast hosted by former Irish president and lawyer Mary Robson and comedian Maeve Hines, is a beacon of hope. It showcases how women around the world are banding together to fight for solutions that are generating remarkable momentum. The first episode, we meet women among lawyers, activists, university students and children who are bravely suing governments and multinationals over climate negligence. Tessa Khan, a Bangladeshi Australian lawyer, explains that most legal systems contain duties of care that make it incumbent on governments to protect their citizens from harm. These can be interpreted as including climate change. There have been some spectacular successes. In 2015, for example, Dutch environmental group Gender won the first citizen-led climate litigation case against a government. Its legal team successfully argued that the Netherlands was not doing enough to avert dangerous climate change. In response, the court ordered the government to reduce carbon dioxide emissions by 25% by 2020. Marjan Manissa, the Dutch lawyer who co-formed Agenda, tells Robson and Higgins she, quote, did not imagine what it would spark off. The victory inspired hundreds of copycat cases and boosted the Dutch-Bolivian filmmaker Chiro Gersenbuch calls our collective boldness Girls Book, who was once one of the 668 co-planters in the Agenda case, is now one of the 10,000 Dutch citizens suing the fossil fuel giant Shell. Quote, we're moving the bar again, she says. Climate litigation has particularly been embraced by women, says Robertson, who has become a committed climate campaigner since her presidency. Quote, it really reflects my own experiences of travelling the world, she explains, adding that it's women in general who are just rolling up their sleeves and getting on with it. Khan says that maybe because women are disproportionately affected by climate change. She says that research has found that women are more likely than men to die of natural disasters and experience the effect of food and water shortages due to their traditional caregiving roles. Girls and young women who will be impacted by climate change for the longest have been especially active. Rab Ali from Pakistan, for example, was only 7 years old when she sued her government in 2016. In Karachi, the pollution level is very high. It directly affects IQs at levels of kids, she tells Robson and Higgins. Rithma Pardi, an 11-year-old from India, Sarah Thompson, a New Zealand law student, have also launched similar cases against their governments. Robson and Higgins also speak to Kersley Juliana of Victoria Barrett, two of the 21 young people who will be entering a court in October to argue that the US government is violating their right to life, liberty and prosperity by allowing fossil fuel use. Quote, I genuinely am optimistic that our government will listen to us and hear our demands, said Juliana. Of course, it remains to be seen whether collective action will be any meaningful impact. The outcome of the Uganda case, for example, remains uncertain after the Dutch government launched an appeal. Many of the subsequent climate change litigations have also failed, including those seeking to block Australia's plan to build the country's biggest ever coal mine. Nevertheless, listening to Robertson Higgson podcast is enough to make anyone want to roll up their sleeves. As Thompson tells them, quote, courage is contagious, and when you see other people dedicated to fighting the cause, it's hard not to be inspired by that. In future episodes, the jurors will showcase women who are who are fighting fossil fuels outside the courtroom, for example, campaigning against plastic and helping spread the solar power to developing countries. Oh dear, this is over the top. Next article, and we're 4 minutes in. Meg the Shark Lives Again by Michael Marshall. The megalodon would eat Jason Statham for lunch, says Michael Stratham. This is Michael Marshall. The Meg. It's going in US. It's a film review. A film's called The Meg. Going for a fun night at the movies, this mouth could find you in front of Jason Statham facing off against a giant megalodon, a long extinct shark far larger than today's great whites. As a film, The Meg is not high art, but is expected to do well at the box office, partly because it embraces the inherent daftness of its presence. Unlike Jaws, which features a living species, The Meg is a Jurassic World of shark movies. This may well be a good thing because it's unlikely to scare us out of the water or encourage us to kill them all attitude towards sharks, which many of which endangers the species. The little megalodon gets a lot of press, giving the impression we know a lot about it. We don't, says paleontologist Darren Nash at the University of Southampton, UK. Pretty much all we have is teeth, which are startling big, a record of 16.8 centimetres from base to tip. Being sharks, their skeletons were made of cartilage rather than bone and didn't fossilise. There are a few vertebrae, but that's all. As a result, the basics like the length are an estimate, derived from measuring the teeth. A shark, the Meg, is apparently 75 to 90 feet, or 22 to 27 metres. This is an exaggeration, Nash, says Nash. Current thinking puts it around 15 to 20 metres. Reconstructions of the jaws are large enough for a person to sit inside. A photo are also exaggerated. But the megalodon was a whopper, capable of eating Stratham for lunch. The lack of bones also means we don't know what they looked like or where they fit in the shark family. Some are in the group called Lamniformes, says Nash. Also known as the mackerel sharks, the group includes the species from great whites to basking megalomouth and goblin sharks. People imagine megalodon as a huge white, but Nash is not sure. However, we do know the megalodon ate. There are bite marks on whales and dolphin bones that come right at the right time. It does seem to have been a marine animal predator. That's to be expected. It was a great white sharks eat. Well, remarkably, this species uses shallow water ecosystems like the Panama Bay for an nursery, says Catalina Pirma of Swansea University, UK. Unusually small megalodon teeth from this region may be from juveniles which stayed there until they were big enough to hunt in the open sea. Despite claims, including Disney's Discovery Channel program, megalodons are unlikely to lurk in the sea today. They went extinct 2.6 million years ago, according to a study co-authored by Pimento. One possible reason might have been the evolution of competitors like the great white sharks or orcas, which left megalodons struggling for food. The big reveal came in 2017, when Pimento's team discovered a megalodon was just one victim of the hitherto unknown extinction event. Among the large marine animals, 36% of the genera became extinct around the same time. The key seems to have been the changing sea levels, which reduced the volume of the shallow coastal waters and the megalodon's nurseries. As of its survival today, there are two main lines of reported evidence, says Nash. Megalodon teeth have been found and claimed to be just 10,000 years old, and there are a few sightings. Nash and his co-authors examined these in their book Cryptozoologian and found them to be all tall tales and hoaxes, or their mistakes. Finishing off quickly, Scotland's secret weapon. Sure, how we see the sea, a touring sea festival. Scotland's secret weapon, something is stirring on the tiny island of Arran, says Simon Ings. Nobody catches much fish around the island of Arran now. Overfishing and population hit the wild populations hard. There's still plenty of fish, mind, not free swimming, but cooped up in huge salmon farms that leach detritus, pesticides and antibiotics, plastic waste into the Firth of Clyde. And yet, it is to Arran that Scotland's coastal communities have turned to see working vision of a cleaner, healthier, more productive ocean. Arran's Lammash Bay became a community marine reserve in January 2008. It's a no-take zone helping local mackerel and fragile pink coral-like algae, which provides a habitat for sponges, sea squirts, crabs, squat lobsters and scallops. The hope is that the commercial species such as cod will use this area to recover their numbers and then spill out into the surrounding sea. Meanwhile, the 280 square kilometres of South Arun marine protected area restricts trawling and dredging. Community development, it is the first of a kind and has been taken up by the Scottish Government with the creation of 30 more MPAs covering some 20% of the country's seas. Restoring Scottish sea life after decades of pollution, dredging, overfishing is not going to be easy. Quote, we've got a long way to go just to get the environment back to the condition it was 50 years ago, said Howard Wood, founder of the local advocacy organisation Coast, called the Community of Arun Seabed Trust. Most ministers, he added, are only interested in what the environment provides or used to provide and how much we can wring from it within 5 years. The exciting thing about Coast is the armoury it brings to the battle against biopia of politicians. Glasgow and York University are monitoring Arun's coastal waters, while Coast is working with a local tourist organisation to develop dive sites. Even more impressively, it has won over the local fishing community. Multimedia festival Shore, How We See the Coast, is the latest addition to Coast's arsenal. This festival of coastal life is created by in Arun, is now circling the Scottish coast before it ends up in Edinburgh's Dynamic Earth Science theme park in April 2019. It's curated by Invisible Dust, a UK-wide organisation that pairs scientists with artists to explore clear environmental issues. The founder, Alice Sharp, has commissioned two filmmakers despite the lack of cinemas in the north of Scotland. But the Shore Festival does not lack technical backup. It's a screen machine, a large blue lorry that unpacks transformer-like into a comfortable 80-seater surround cinema. Margaret Salmon's Kaldach explores the shoreline of the Water Ross Marine Protected Area and the community bordering Ullapool. Quote, imagine someone spending time in a town and then drifting back to the beach and into the sea. Margaret's film is like a journey from one medium to another. Oh, God, this sounds a bit weird, says Sharp. The second film, called I Walk There Every Day, Never Saw It That Way, by Eb Webb Ingle, is a very different proposition after the first installment in the community video project's aim is to get Scotland's coastal communities talking to each other. It's an old idea. Webb Ingle says, in the late 1970s, the National Film Board of Canada invited filmmaker Colin Lau to visit the Fogo Library in Ireland in Newfoundland, whose fishing community was collapsing. Quote, Lau made a short film of a group of one part of the island and then showed to the other group. Soon the different communities that interested had a conversation going, and more sustainable fishing began to emerge. Quote, the myth among filmmakers is that the Fokker process rejuvenated the islands, says Webb Ingle. Others reckon that we're doing the work already. Salmon is inclined to agree. These precarious communities are experienced at centuries of ebb and flows. They're strong people. That's a bit of a weird article. Can't be much longer to the end of this book. And that, my friends, is the end of New Scientist. There's letters which I'll read. Yep, I'll just read the letters. That'll get me up. So this is letters to the New Scientist. Focus on methane to reach climate target. From Ilka Schlavikan, Helsinki, Finland. Our climate seems to be changing faster than estimated. The goal of climate policy set out in Paris Agreement is to keep the global average temperature well below 2 degrees. We would be more likely to attain it if we gave more weight to methane and greenhouse gases. In climate policy reporting, emissions of all greenhouse gases are converted using their global warming potential over GWP over 100 years. On this horizon, methane affects as about 25 times that of the same mass of carbon dioxide. Using GWP indicates that it contributes about 20% of the CO2 effect. But methane typically stays in the atmosphere for only 12 years. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has published a GWP value of 18 for 85 for methane over 20 years. Using this figure illustrates its contribution to warming more realistically, as methane presence influences more than half of CO2. If we shorten the DWT time horizon, we emphasize reducing methane emissions can thus accelerate the achievement of the Paris goal. So that's methane, and methane is largely produced in cow guts by ancient bacteria. Kangaroos don't produce it. Citizen science needs to track biodiversity. From Peter Fish Kosminder, London, UK. Graham Lawthorne says it's often difficult to discuss biodiversity because of insufficient data. The reason for this is unclear, but I expect the time and money may play a role. Could those in need of such data turn to citizen science? This involves members of the public giving such time as they have available to various surveys. Some, like me, are retired research-trained scientists who have no intentions of dying while watching TV and offer our knowledge and experience gladly. Butterflies... Okay. Also on the same topic, your quote, UK TV naturalist Chris Pickerman says he saw no butterflies over 2 days in his Hampshire garden. I recently joined a staff member of the Yorkshire Wildlife Trust and another volunteer on a butterfly counting transect near our home. It may give Peckham hope that we recorded more than 100 butterflies belonging to 12 species in little over an hour, though we saw only one example of each of the two of those species. Wow. Consider the bluebells when finding species. It was interesting but counterintuitive that a species is not a natural concept. It's a human construct, an idea to help categorize and log and aid to our understanding of rich variety of life. Its origins are in the religious texts and the idea a boon to post-enlightenment collectors and taxonomists. As with all constructs and models designed to represent natural phenomena, there are limits to their effectiveness. They are tools to aid elucidation, not ends in their own right. It should come as no surprise that there are areas in nature where species boundaries are unclear. For example, the common bluebell, hyacinth, is inevitably interbreeds in Britain with the Spanish bluebell. It has spawned vigorously invasive and not only weakly scented hybrid bluebell. Could this mistake the bluebell more able to cope with climate change? To try and see trial and error, that evolution will answer that question over time. Again, a bit hard to understand. More eyes, the better for medical diagnosis. Your interview with Regina Baisley and her working using artificial intelligence to detect cancer was both interesting and encouraging. When a friend went to a mammogram, it was inspected by a surgeon who thought it was clear, and by two other members of the staff who thought it was not quite certain. A further check found the problem. It was a very early stage and was cleared relatively easily and quickly and permanently. It seems to me that we can't get AI into service soon enough as a backup partner for the hard-pressed teams making life-changing decisions. We'll need to be alert, though, to the peril. Danger of basing research on boring risks. Jennifer Phillips of Westwood, Massachusetts. Claire Wilson reports that low levels of neurotransmitter dopamine are associated with risk-taking. From what I read about risk-taking research, it seems most based on money or gambling decisions. This may not be a good choice for behavior sampling. I, for instance, have been a skydiver, a scuba diver, and have enjoyed motorcycle rides and launched into training for a profession in which I had zero female role models. All of these were risky by some measures. I find I'm fiscally conservative and would never gamble money. I find research models based on this boring. I would never enroll in such a study. There must be others like me. Ah, okay. So the people are self-selecting for it. Why are diagnoses of autism increasing by Guy Cox? Oh, I know Guy Cox of Sydney, Australia. I actually know Guy Cox. He's if it's the same Guy Cox, I think it would be a scientist, retired scientist at Sydney University. You say the number of people diagnosed with autism has been climbing, leading to claims of an environmental cause, but that increase is probably down to the explanation in the definition of autism and greater awareness. I'm sure it's true, but I still wonder about another likely cause. Couples are often having children much later in life. An association has been found between autism and provincial age, more recently correlations with both maternal age and a wide disparity of age between parents have been shown. Could the trend towards starting a family later in life be a key factor? I am convinced there is a cat killer in London. I'm very disappointed to read Severin Harris' claims that the word cat killer in London could not be all explained by foxes in the road traffic. As someone who has seen the work of all three, I can assure him that's not that simple. I called by a neighbour to see if the dead cat in her backyard was a mime. It wasn't, but observed the body had both hind legs and fore legs arranged together in a geometric centre of the lawn, where it could be seen from a bedroom window. There was fur scattered in the lawn, but little near the body. There was a single straight wound behind the ear and shoulder, deep enough to expose the spine but not to decapitate. There's no blood anywhere. I'm sure this was the work. It was not the work of a fox chewing with weak jaws. Harris does not claim to have seen any of the recently killed cats, but dismisses suspicion of a killer as a media hype based on an observation of killings attributed to a Satanist in 1990. Use empty glacial valleys for pompous storage. That's a good idea. Eric Foxcroft, St Albans, Herefordshire, UK. Fred Pierce observes that hydroelectric dams have fallen out of favour for many environmentalists in recent years. This is certainly because drown habitats with increasing greenhouse gas emissions, but they also take up land and could be put to use. Global warming is calling glaciers to retreat. The valleys they vacate seem ideal places to build hydroelectric dams, particularly for pumped storage, with no natural habitat to destroy, no human population or agriculture to disturb. The disadvantage of much of such sites is their distance from customers, but high voltage direct current power lines are lowering barriers for long distance transmissions. I like that idea. Checking online urban folklore since 1994. Miko Hare asks whether anyone is prepared to vouch for the veracity of an otherwise of his three tall tales. I'll direct him to the snoops.com. I don't want the, I'm going to have to skip that because I don't know what the tales are. A machine shall speak garbage unto machine. You quote Ligano Forge saying there is no such thing as an independent fake news bot unleashed on the web like some sort of alien life taking root. Does it mean it's impossible or merely that no one knows to have done it yet? It is impossible for someone to design a social media bot that transmits itself as a worm into to invade as many poorly protected devices as possible and makes random changes to code after a certain number of replies. Sooner or later, the mutant might respond a thousandfold to the daughter's bot tweets or other postings, thereby drastically improving their chances of reproducing. The result could be ultimate in futility, with the machine speaking garbage into a machine and locking up the whole web. When we have to think about the energy consumed by servers, its effect on climate, oh god, well, he got them. The origin and purpose are still a total mystery. Colin Barris seemed somewhat surprised that primates, including our ancestors, quote, stumbled into the Stone Age by chance. How else might a species realize the usefulness of stone tools and other buzzrolling era? Or is thinking that a cultural leap normally requires the presence of a large black monolith, perhaps discovered in space station, what's the year 2000, whatever it is, Space Odyssey. Thanks for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you.
how you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.